You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Matt Walsh, Brian Wolfmiller, and Hans Feeney at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. All paid registrants will have the ability to watch the conference live and on demand. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385. You've heard of gaslighting, haven't you? Well, it's from an old play where a husband tries to convince his wife that she's going insane. He's not just playing a trick. He is trying to drive her insane. Sometimes you feel that when you look out into society, all levels of society, legal, social, academia, all of those places, and there are entire groups of people who are acting like this, what we're going through right now in terms of the sexual revolution. Well, this is the way it's always been. We've always had hordes of young people deciding that they aren't the gender they were born into. Boys that are girls and girls that are boys. And they act like, why are you just noticing this? Well, there are some of us who realize that the goalposts have changed and that something has changed, especially with respect to young women. We're going to be talking about the transgender epidemic among young women. Abigail Schreier is our guest. She's a writer for the Wall Street Journal, a graduate of Yale Law School, and author of the new book, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Abigail, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You say that your commitment to First Amendment issues led you into the world of transgender politics through the back door. What do you mean by that?
So I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal about pronoun laws. We have laws in two states, New York and California, assigning criminal penalties to people who do not use someone's pronouns of choice. And that's just straightforwardly unconstitutional. Under the First Amendment, the government can't make people say things. It actually can't make them say anything. So I wrote a piece about this, pointing that out, and a reader wrote to me and said, my daughter's been caught up in this epidemic. There are a lot of us. We're all over the country. We're in support groups. No one will take up our cause. Would you be willing to write about it?
How in the world did gender dysphoria become an epidemic, a social contagion among young women?
So the thing to know about this is that though they call it gender dysphoria, it doesn't look like real gender dysphoria. So real gender dysphoria, we have a over 100-year diagnostic history of it now, and it usually originates with boys ages 2 to 4, preschool-age boys, who are terribly uncomfortable in their biological sex, who maybe refuse to play with other boys, insist that they're really girls. Sometimes they even punch their own, you know, private anatomy. They're terribly uncomfortable. And in some cases, these kids don't outgrow, in many cases, they outgrow it. The majority of these children outgrow it, but in some cases they didn't, and they became, you know, what was known as transsexual men. For the first time in history, the predominant demographic is teenage girls with no childhood history of gender dysphoria. We've never seen anything like this, and it's true all across the West now. America, the UK, Scandinavia, all across the West.
How is gender dysphoria related to what is being observed as a general decline in the mental health of young women?
So that's actually what it's about. Teenage girls are in profound psychological distress. We have never seen rates of anxiety and depression so high as they are now. We have tweens that are committing suicide in numbers we've never seen before and self-harming in numbers we've never seen before. So we know that girls are in terrible distress. And when girls are in distress, sometimes they latch on to an explanation that they see in the culture or something they see in the culture. And for a while, it was anorexia. Oh, I'm so fat. That's the problem. If only if I weren't so fat. Today, the thing they reach for is gender dysphoria. It's not an accurate diagnosis, but it is something they talk themselves into.
You say that girls who identify as transgender, quote, flee womanhood like a house on fire, their minds fixed on escape, not on any particular destination. What do you mean by that?
So if you've ever seen the biopic, Boys Don't Cry, it's with Hilary Swank, you saw an example of one of the very, very rare but genuine gender dysphoric women, biological women. It was a true story about a woman, Tina Brandon, and she really was uncomfortable clearly from a very young age with being a woman, and she really wanted everyone to treat her and take her for being a man, and she tried to hide her feminine identity from everyone. That is not what these girls are like. So they don't really want to be a man. They don't undergo phalloplasty, the bottom surgery. They don't try to obtain the appendage most people would consider a defining feature of manhood. They don't really want to be a man. They don't have the habits of men. They don't act like men. What they're looking to be usually is queer. They want to be identified in the LGBTQ space. They're very comfortable being associated in that category because it gives them a certain victimhood status. But they're not really interested in becoming men.
So what you're saying here is that if this were genuine gender dysphoria, according to the clinical definition, they would be seeking by one form or another to at least pass for men.
That's right, but they're not seeking that. So, you know, most of the young girls I profile, when they cover themselves, they get a lot of tattoos, but they always do feminine ones, flowers, cartoon creatures, things like that, or they paint their nails, or they have various piercings. They're not really trying to come across completely as men. And I also interviewed a number of transgender adults for the book, and they're very different. So they're not part of this social contagion. They didn't become transgender because of YouTube. And unlike these girls, they really are seeking to pass. And you can see that from the way they live their lives.
So when you look this up on the internet, you will see these cases of young women who have entirely transitioned. They have body hair. They look for all the world like men. They build up their muscles and things like that. That's the genuine article there as opposed to what you're talking about.
Well, it depends. So the girls that are not, that are part of the social contagion, first of all, they had no childhood history of gender dysphoria, unlike kids with the actual condition, right? So we know this is an atypical form of gender dysphoria at the very least, okay? But the other thing is they're really looking to be identified as queer rather than male. Okay, they're not trying to live as men. They don't pick up the hobbies of men. They don't drive trucks and lift weights and do things that might be stereotypically men, male, which is more what genuine, you know, people with typical gender dysphoria often sought to do. And they arrive at it in a very different way as well. They often come to this idea that they're gender dysphoric from the internet, from social media. They watch these transgender influencers online, and they hear about them in the schools, and it becomes a very popular thing to do.
So tell us some of these stories about girls who have succumbed to the social contagion.
So very often these are very precocious girls. They're high anxiety. They're very bright. They're very sheltered. They're upper middle or middle class white girls. And what they're looking for more than anything is acceptance and belonging, which is not always easy to achieve when you're a white girl at school or university. And their anxiety is real, is very real, but they're looking for an escape from that. And they sort of latch onto this as a way of choosing both an escape from the social anxiety, because now they have a club to belong to. One of the things about testosterone is it does relieve anxiety. It delivers a kind of euphoria, and it makes you socially less afraid. And the thing to know about this generation is they're very sheltered, and they have a lot of social anxiety. They don't spend a lot of time with each other, and they have a lot of trouble interacting.
Why is the research of Lisa Littman important?
So Lisa Littman did the scientific research that is the basis for the book. That was the jumping off point in the book. I looked at many aspects of the culture, but hers is the scientific research. She's a public health researcher at Brown University, and she noticed that all of a sudden there were all these teenage girls coming out as transgender, and the prevalence was startlingly high within friend groups. So it was actually 70 times the expected rate within friend groups. Now, even if you imagine that maybe they were coming out as transgender because there are fewer barriers to that today, you wouldn't expect 70 times the prevalence rate in friend groups, and you wouldn't expect it from a demographic that had never experienced gender dysphoria in any significant numbers before, and now all of a sudden was the dominant demographic. So she looked into this, and she hypothesized that she noticed that this was the same population that also spreads and shares anorexia, cutting, bulimia, and other social contagions.
How does she explain the contagious nature of this atypical form of gender dysphoria?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the internet. The parents she surveyed noticed that the children, and in fact, my interviews confirm this, had spent a tremendous amount of time steeping themselves in social media beforehand. The number of transgender influencers on YouTube and other forms of social media are legion, and they are really wonderfully produced videos. They're very catchy, and they promise escape from all the uncomfortable things about female adolescence. Testosterone also gets rid of your period. It also redistributes fat, so you feel better about your body. And it does all these things, and girls today spend less time hanging out with their friends in person and more time on the internet. And she noticed that these girls who suddenly came out with and decided they had gender dysphoria with no childhood history had often, this has often been preceded by a period of prolonged social media exposure and immersion.
When we come back, we're going to talk about those trans influencers on the internet and social media and what their message is to young women. Abigail Schreier is our guest. We're talking about the transgender epidemic among young women. Stay tuned.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the transgender epidemic among young women with Abigail Schreier. She is author of the new book, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Woke Ideology with Matt Walsh of The Daily Wire. The U.S. Constitution and Civic Virtue with Dr. Robert George of Princeton University. And 1 hour with Molly Hemingway of Fox News and Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations, responding to questions and comments from viewers of the 2020 Virtual Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. Registration is $135. It allows you to watch the conference live and on demand. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. or call 618-223-8385, the 2020 Virtual Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference. Abigail, you mentioned these trans influencers online. Who are they, and what is their message to young women?
So they're a motley crew. I would describe them as probably the worst influence in every school times a thousand in a certain sense, because they're incredibly charismatic. They've produced these videos, and you know, some of them are very nice. I've interviewed some of them, but they are really exuberant enthusiasts about things like testosterone, which can indeed do things that are very comfortable for young women, suppress anxiety, suppress depression, and redistribute fat. But of course, they also have very detrimental long-term effects.
So the trans influencers, do they essentially say to young women, if you think you might be trans, you are?
That's a very, very common repeated line. If you have ever thought you might be trans, if you ever thought that you're not entirely a girl, you probably are something else. And unfortunately, this is backed up by everything these kids are learning in school now, where they are taught that there is a spectrum of gender. There are all sorts of genders to choose from. And anyone who is not absolutely on the princess extreme is imperfectly feminine or gender nonconforming. So then the question is, which gender would you like to choose?
So talk a little bit more about schools and what role they're playing in exacerbating this epidemic.
Sure. So I went very deep into the California public schools because we have, California is where I live, and we have some of the most extensive and radical public school mandatory gender identity curriculum. It's part of our sexual orientation and gender identity curriculum. Parents are not permitted to opt out because it's not considered part of sex education. It's part of the anti-bullying education. So the idea is that in order to prevent bullying, every student must take this gender identity instruction.
You say that schools aren't forcing adolescents to identify as transgender, but they are greasing the skids. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of celebration that goes on from the moment you choose one of these brave identities, okay? School has become, if you just look at the calendar and I lay this out, a sort of nonstop pride parade. There, almost every single month, there are one or more celebrations for an LGBTQ identity right in the schools. It is incredibly valorized. At the same time, there's a real in-group, out-group sense that the ones who oppose this are haters. They're the opposite of allies, they're enemies, and they're trying to stop you from being who you really are. So it really appeals to natural rebelliousness of adolescence.
And all of this at a time, adolescence for girls and boys as well, but especially for girls where their identity is closely tied to their social group.
That's exactly right. The reason this hits girls so hard is they're very socially sensitive, and they're on social media, which honestly is driving a kind of madness. Instead of just comparing how you look to the girl, the popular girl at her locker, you're being bombarded by airbrushed images of her. You're seeing her out with her friends excluding you. You're seeing how many more likes she gets, and you see a number. And very often, people are also writing cruel comments on your pictures. So these young girls are in terrible distress, and what they want more than anything is to escape their bodies at a time when their bodies are giving them a lot of problems.
So where does this gender dysphoria epidemic among young women leave their parents?
The parents go through a period of terrible distraught over this. You know, by and large, most of the parents I interview are politically liberal. They are progressive parents. They are very open to LGBTQ rights and supported gay marriage. And so when the daughter comes to them and says, I think I might be lesbian, they embrace that and they embrace her, even though she may only be 12 or 13 and have never kissed a boy or a girl, they're ready to sort of embrace that and celebrate that. The problem is that what the girl sometimes is really looking for is rebellion. So the moment that doesn't get them the upset that they're looking for, they dial it up and say, actually, I'm really trans. At that point, the parents are very much alone because they're desperate to get their daughter not to hurt herself, and everyone turns against them.
They are being told, and it's just remarkable how much this kind of emotional blackmail is a part of this social contagion. The parents are told, if you don't entirely affirm your daughter in this notion, she's likely to kill herself.
You know, it's the kind of thing that one would think you would only say to a parent, if ever, as a therapist in the direst of circumstances. But today, therapists trot this out immediately. It's a first response to any parent who says, hold on, she never was even tomboyish, or she never seemed to have gender dysphoria. This doesn't seem like her, and her mental health is getting worse. Any parent who tries to object to the fast-tracking of medical and social transition is treated like a bigot.
And this is coming from the therapeutic community that parents are seeking help from.
That's right. The moment they express any concern or opposition or even skepticism about this, they're threatened with this suicide, your daughter will kill yourself, and they will say to her, would you rather have a live son or a dead daughter? And this brings basically, you know, almost every parent completely to their knees. They're at that point paralyzed because that's the last thing they want.
Did you look at all into parents who feel cornered into this kind of affirmation and eventually just say, well, this is the way it is?
Yes, many did. I mean, some of them went along with it. They were, you know, very progressive. They were very open-minded. And at first they thought, well, I guess if someone says they're transgender, they are, and they go along with it. And what they very often report is that their daughters actually become more confirmed in the identity, more determined to go through all kinds of hormonal and surgical treatments, and more unhappy. So at that point, when they realize this is not alleviating their distress to be treated as a boy, in fact, it seems to be making them worse, at that point, they try to reverse course.
So tell us about some of the researchers and medical professionals who are daring to question the headlong affirmation of this kind of transgenderism.
You know, when I wrote the article that became the basis for this book, all kinds of physicians reached out to me, psychiatrists, students in medical school, and they reached out to me and they said, this is not why we went into the profession. I'm a surgeon. I did not train to destroy biological capacity. I trained in order to help people. But if I speak out about this, I'll be fired from my job. It sounded like I was talking to doctors in the Soviet Union.
What do they do? Do they remain silent?
Sometimes they feel like they have to. And, you know, I, for instance, talked to one top microsurgeon who refuses to perform these operations based on patient demand. He didn't go into his job in order to destroy biological capacity. And he said that because he won't do it, these are such big moneymaker surgeries for his hospital that this hospital has been letting far less qualified surgeons perform these operations. And of course, that's really the last thing we want is really putting these patients at even greater risk.
Talk a little bit about how the trans rights movement has found itself colliding with the L in LGBTQ.
You know, I interviewed a lot of lesbians in the course of writing this book, and one thing to note is that lesbians have really had it rough with the rise of the transgender movement. And the reason is lesbians accept biological sex, as do gay men usually. They say, look, we are same-sex attracted. We are, by definition, we consider sex really important. What we don't consider important is gender, meaning the set of sex stereotypes society meaninglessly ascribes. And of course, they're right. But because they insist that there's a difference between men and women, they find themselves constantly harassed by men who identify as women and insist that they are really lesbian and try to break into their groups.
Talk a little bit about the dangers of the use of puberty blockers and other kinds of hormone therapy that go along with this social contagion.
Well, the dangers are legion. So you start with puberty blockers. Puberty blockers occur a little bit before my demographic. So they usually before puberty hits. So ages 8 to 11, you'd put a kid on puberty blockers, and it shuts down the part of their pituitary that stimulates puberty. The problem with that, of course, is many things. Hormones shower not only the sexual organs and direct the development of sexual organs in developing the size and the capacity for orgasm and the secondary sex characteristics, but they also shower the brain. And we have no idea what the long-term effects of this will be.
What have you learned about transgender regret?
So I've interviewed a lot of detransitioners. That's young women who've gone through some medical transition and then regretted it and come back. And what I can tell you is because these girls are not suffering from genuine gender dysphoria, unsurprisingly, hormonal and surgical transition does not alleviate their distress. So there is a lot of regret already. There was a subreddit, you know, on Reddit, that social media, there was a subreddit of detransitioners. It already was up to, I think, 13,000 members, up from, I think, the time I checked it a few months before, it was around 7,000. I mean, the numbers are growing every day. As more girls are caught up in this contagion, more girls are also, you know, reaching the age where they come to their senses and say, what have I done?
Finally, what advice would you have for parents who want to inoculate their daughters against this gender ideology?
Few things. Number one, social media is, I hate to use this word, but it's toxic. It does only bad things for their kids. They should do whatever they can to keep their children off of it. Second, they really should oppose identity announcements. The children should not be announcing their sexuality to the world or their gender identity to the world online. And the reason is because they're often 12 and 13 and they may change their minds and they don't want them to ever lock themselves into an identity that they might be embarrassed by down the road and regret. And the third thing is, you know, I give a lot more in the book, but the third thing I would say is absolutely oppose gender indoctrination in schools. There is no reason that you can't show compassion for transgender students and compassion for sexual minorities without indoctrinating the student body. There's no need for it.
Abigail Schreier is a writer for the Wall Street Journal. She's a graduate of Yale Law School and author of the new book, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Talk On Demand Archives, and look for Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier. Abigail, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's This Week in Pop Christianity with Chris Rosebro. We'll discuss the prophet Isaiah with Dr. Kevin Golden. On Friday, we'll talk with Dr. Ryan McPherson about Lutherans' political resistance and the Magdeburg Confession of 1550. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.